You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
And we're back. It's that time of the week again, folks. This is episode 302 of the Columbia Calling podcast. I'm Richard McCall, your host here in Bogota, Colombia. And yes, many of you enjoyed very much last week's show, 301, with Adrian Alsima, the director of Columbia Reports, talking about some of the reasons behind the protests and strikes, which have now been running for 9 days and are set to continue here in Colombia. So tune into that episode. Look back to episode 301, wherever you get your podcasts, because that explains a lot of what's going on in Colombia and the simmering discontent which has been facilitated by the government of Iván Duque. The discontent has been here ever since I've been here, but with the sort of universal hate figure of the FARC, in inverted commas, out of the way. Of course, I know that there's a dissident FARC out there, but with them out of the way, the Colombian people have found their voice in order to make protests and make themselves heard. And so we'll see where this is going. And of course, we'll keep you updated on everything that's going on. But anyway, for those of you out there, remember December 4th, December 8th, there will be national strikes again. So stay safe. Don't do anything stupid. And of course, stay updated on the local media. And of course, by our friends in the international media, those who have been on the show. We're looking at Stephen Grattan, Julia Sims Cobb, Daniel Bador, they've all been on the show, and these guys write the best articles about what's going on here in Colombia at the moment. Well, I'm going to take a short break, but we'll be back with Adrian Alsima with this week's news report, and of course he'll be updating you on what's going on in Colombia. And in segment three, we have very special guest Toby Muse, who is the seasoned war correspondent. He's been embedded with the press there in Iraq, Syria, and has lived in Colombia for some 15 years, and his new book is out in March, and he follows a kilo of cocaine from its production here in Catatumbo, Colombia, all the way up to dealers in the United States. So of course, when that book's out, or pre-order it on Amazon, but be sure to get your hands on a copy. I'm sure it's an excellent read. I'm looking forward to reading it too. So I'm going to leave you in the capable hands of Adrian Alsima. And here comes the news report from Columbia Reports. Thank you again. Bye-bye.
My name is Adrian Alsima, and this is the news for Columbia Calling for December 3, 2019. Colombia's national strike has become almost entirely peaceful after police ended violent attempts to repress the anti-government protests. The strike leaders and President Iván Duque are in a stalemate. The president refuses to talk to the protest organizers, and the social leaders refuse to take part in Duque's so-called national conversation. With the exception of Duque's far-right party, all political parties and the inspector general want the president to engage in negotiations. Lawmakers, local authorities, and international organizations are investigating alleged state involvement in a plot that terrorized residents of Bogota and Cali in the first days of the marches. Using fake reports of mass robberies, President Iván Duque promoted curfews in these cities, after which police allegedly took part in vandalism that terrorized the locals. The national government falsely accused and expelled Venezuelan migrants over vandalism in the aftermath of the terror campaign. The United Nations has condemned the outburst of xenophobia that followed the fake news reports and baseless government accusations. The international organization called on the government and Colombian society to, I quote, continue supporting the Venezuelan population. Anti-Venezuelan sentiments have been growing before the strike already, as their mass migration coincided with an acceleration of unemployment in Colombia. President Ivan Duque's minority coalition in Congress and even his own party are showing severe cracks. The Conservative Party appears to be in rebellion, demanding the president concedes to demands of the leaders of the ongoing protests. Extremist senators from Duque's far-right Democratic Center Party have threatened to split, several senators told local media. Opposition politicians have filed criminal charges against former chief prosecutor Néstor Humberto Martínez. Several former prosecutors have testified that Martínez ordered the illegal wiretapping of politicians and magistrates who were investigating corruption by his former client, banking giant Grupo Aval. According to the former prosecutor general, the accusations are part of a criminal conspiracy. That's the end of this week's news bulletin. Now back to Colombia Calling with Richard McCall.
Yes, this is the third segment of episode 302 of the Colombia Calling podcast. We've got a very special guest on the show, going from strength to strength this year. My very special guest is Toby Muse. He's a very, well, long-time foreign correspondent and war reporter. He's been embedded in Iraq and Syria and, of course, lived a great deal of his journalism life here in Colombia. And that's why we've got him on the show. We'll be talking about his book coming out in March 2020. It's called Kilo: Inside the Deadliest Cocaine Cartels, From the Jungles to the Streets. And so we want to talk about how this book came about and what it's about, and of course, you know, encourage you all out there to buy it. So welcome on Colombia Calling, Toby, and thank you for agreeing to come on the show.
Thank you for having me. I think it's really interesting what you're doing. It's a great podcast, and I think it's, you know, yeah, it's a very interesting week to hear these different opinions about the country that continues to mystify us all. And, you know, yeah.
Well, it does mystify us. I think we could live here a lifetime and never unravel and never, you know, come to an agreement between a group of small people, even on what's going on in Colombia. But how long were you here full time reporting on, you know, from the front lines here in Colombia, Toby?
So I arrived for one peace process and essentially left with another one. I arrived for the peace process of Caguán. So I arrived in the year 2000. And I was going down to see the FARC there in San Vicente del Caguán. And then I left in the year 2017. Yeah, that sounds right. 2017.
So, and recently,
I lived there. Pardon?
Recently. I mean, really recently. I thought, for some reason, I thought you were away earlier than that.
No. I basically covered the peace process the other peace process with the FARC that finally put an end to their war. And after that, shortly, I left. Because, I think I've been a freelance journalist all my life, and I think there are changes going on within journalism that can make it very tough. Like, foreign correspondent as a job is in more danger than I've ever seen in my life. And essentially, not to drag on too much, but when I looked at the election of Donald Trump, I thought, my God, and Brexit, I thought these are going to be the stories. There's not going to be any budget left over for foreign correspondent. And unfortunately, I've kind of been proved right a lot on that. There's just been overwhelming concentration on Donald Trump and Brexit in England. And again, people are just not seeing the foreign news anymore as much as they once did.
I think you've hit the nail right on the head there, because I mean, obviously, my work has never been as widespread or so on and so forth. But I found myself competing for less money and for lighter stories. And yes, the budget isn't there. What I was paid 10 years ago, 15 years ago, isn't even a fraction, you know, of what they would pay me today. And the bandwidth, as you say, taken up by Brexit and Trump, just means that there's nothing left over at all. And we find ourselves in this different situation and this different journalism spectrum. And I just don't know where it's going. I don't know, I'm in my 40s. Should I really be sort of evolving and trying to keep up with the new trends? Or should I be, you know, branching out alone and doing my own thing and just jobbing a bit here and jobbing a bit there? It becomes quite a dilemma, you know.
Absolutely. I feel you completely. I'm thinking exactly along the same lines. And I think we're seeing the entire model. I was I started thinking about all of these streaming services, and I wondered, are we basically seeing the collapse of the model of the media of the past, 100 years, advertising, or are we essentially seeing that collapse? Because I don't know. I don't know if the media can be supported anymore. It doesn't seem to be. And we seem to be retreating into these streaming services. So it's Netflix, it's Disney, it's going to be HBO. In the past, these channels were able to exist by using advertising. It seems that that's no longer the case. I don't know. The media has a very grim, it's a grim outlook on the horizon. And it's very annoying to me to hear journalism professors talking about, oh, this is the golden age of journalism. No, it's not. You know, there's too much of, oh, we're going back to the Watergate. Journalists cannot, the wages that are being paid in journalism, it's just shocking. I don't think the rest of the world understands how much a journalist may have to pay out of their own pocket in order to do the travel and then try and get that money back from an outlet. I don't think people understand that. Like if you told a plumber or a lawyer, oh yeah, you're going to have to spend $1,000 to go do this job, and then later you'll get that money back 3 months later, I think they would look at you and say, what, are you crazy? And journalists would just do that all the time. So I think it's a very grim outlook.
And of course, if they pay you in the 3 months.
Yeah. And, you know, these cowboy ventures where they just don't pay. And I think within some very, very major media companies, I am sure it's part of the business plan to get a certain percentage of correspondents just to give up. I'm sure of that. And they hire these accountants who just are complete buffoons who get everything wrong and then say, you need to resend the forms, and then there's this, and then there's that. I've had to sue. I'm not a person who walks around threatening to sue people, but various times I've had to send that email after a year of fighting the accountancy department. This is it. I'm sending these emails to a lawyer and I'll be suing you. And then they kind of finally come around, you know, but it's just, it's a bad gig at the moment.
It is a bad gig. I mean, you know, fortunately, Latin America does have, a spotlight on it at the moment, but it won't be forever. I mean, you know, many years back, Hugo Chavez made Latin America interesting again. And then we sort of dipped again. And then Maduro came up and sort of took a bit of that influence back. And the peace, the peace accords and so on. And right now with, let's say, the unrest in Latin America has drawn, but you can already see it fading. You can already see the interest waning as we move into the Christmas months. And of course, you know, we've got an election in the UK in December. I mean, what psychopath plans an election for December, for Christmas time? So this will take away from whatever is going to occur in these areas and people who want, let's say, the news. So you went back to the US, where you're now based in DC, and you put this book together and scored a book deal, which is amazing as well. So, you know, you got a book deal. But of course, you know, this is something, the topic, the cocaine trade, on the back of narcos and everything else. So, and of course, Pablo Escobar really never ever goes out of style. He's always up some. There is interest in his myth, let's say, and an interest in what goes on around the cocaine trade. So you got this book deal and you put it together how long did it take you to write this? This topic is something you've been reporting on now for a better part of two decades. So you must have had the information there already.
I did. But I mean, one of the key notes, I think, especially for people who have experience of Colombia, one of the things I was so keen to get down on the page was how Colombians speak, because that fills me with endless happiness to listen to every person, especially once you get out of Bogota, every person in that country is a poet. You can be next to someone who's illiterate, but their form, the way they invent different ways of saying the same things, just even if you go into kind of gang terminology about how many different ways there is to use the words to kill someone. So, you know, it became important for me to come back and like really just sit down and listen to these people, do these interviews. And I wanted to do a book that essentially doesn't really doesn't really speak to experts or analysts. I feel like that book has been done, the kind of the history of the cocaine trade. I think that book that has been very well covered, you know, how Pablo Escobar comes out, the Medellin cartel, the Cali cartel. I feel like all of that's been told well. And I never wanted to tell that book. I wanted to tell the story of the men and women who are on the front lines of the war on drugs every day. So the smugglers, the police, the army, the sicarios, the gang members, the capos, their lovers, their witches. That's the story, the U.S. Coast Guard. That's the story I wanted to be. I wanted to tell the story of basically following 1 kilo of cocaine. In this case, it's produced in Catatumbo, down throughout the kind of cartel cocaine ecosystem of parts of Medellin, and then out onto the Pacific Ocean, flowing through Buenaventura. And the idea was to, at each stage of that chain, to really kind of get to know the person whose hands that kilo of cocaine passes through.
That's an amazing story. And I get the, I'm thinking of the map, and for those people out there listening, maybe not too familiar with Colombia's geography, Catatumbo is in the Norte de Santander province or department. That's the Norte de Santander, borders Venezuela. And of course, then if you're going out to Buenaventura in the southwest, you're sort of drawing a line almost diagonally across the country, not completely diagonally, but a light diagonal. And that is an interesting concept to me, because I know that at this moment in time, the ELN, so the, as they say in inverted commas, the remaining guerrilla group in Colombia, is trying to create their own strategic corridor from Venezuela through Catatumbo all the way to the Pacific coast. Was this something that interfered with your investigations and your travel, or did they facilitate it?
I met dissidents, but kind of in one of those very kind of Colombian thing, dissidents of the FARC, in one of those very Colombian scenes of the where she was a dissident, but I didn't talk to her as if she was a dissident. We kind of just had a conversation anyway without acknowledging that she is part of the dissidents, but everyone had said, oh yeah, her and her husband are part of the dissidents. I didn't speak to anyone from the ELN that I know of. But throughout that whole region, I was in a place called La Gabara. I was in different parts of Catatumbo. These are lawless lands. And essentially there are, as you said, there's the ELN, there's the FARC dissidents, but there's also the other group, which is the EPL, is active there. And they're all kind of allying with each other. Then they go to war. But in the essence, it's all about controlling the coca and the cocaine trade. For me to go to parts of La Guevara and to be out there in the coca fields, someone had given permission for that. Now, we did try and push for a more formal interview with the dissidents, and I would have liked that, but we didn't get it. It was a kind of very tense moment there. There was weirdness going on with the border. There had been like these things of Venezuelan troops crossing into Colombia, and the Colombian soldiers started patrolling. And it was just this very, very tense moment. A Venezuelan helicopter flew into Colombian airspace, flew back. And I think it just, the dissidents didn't, you know, were prepared for anything to happen. So they didn't speak to me. I read today, and this is something I've held off believing, but I read it in a newspaper of Norte de Santander, that they say the Mexican Sinaloa cartel is officially established there. I've been very skeptical of this, because if you look at Colombia's conflict and the drug war, essentially all you're looking at is 30 years or 40 years of men and women killing each other to control the land or control the coca, whatever. The idea that they would just welcome in these foreigners always struck me as far-fetched. Apparently I was wrong. Apparently, you know, from good sources, the Mexicans are there. These cartels. So the Norte de Santander is likely to get even wilder at this stage.
My previous life, which came to an end quite recently, of 2 months as an analyst, so we had reasonably secure information that Sinaloa and Nuevo Jalisco cartels were in, I didn't know about Norte Santander, but Cauca. I mean, that's what, but anyway, people seem to be pointing the fingers quite a lot, especially in the end of October, the killings that went on there and the massacres and so on. But apparently, if I get it wrong, I forgive anyone who really knows, Sinaloa cartel is affiliated with the Clan del Golfo and the Nuevo Jalisco with the ELN in Cauca, but it's just finance. And that could obviously switch at any moment. I mean, it's all about, you know, who benefits the most and who's... So that might be... Would you say it could lead to an evolution where you say, you know, when we look at the groups, the EPL, when you were talking of Norte Santander, the EPL, the ELN, the dissidents, and then whomever else is there, and they've been killing one another for the control. Could it be that these other groups, let's say foreign groups, are now coming in and... There's an evolution that now the Colombians are more guns for hire, overseeing the production, which they just sell in country to Mexican cartels?
I mean, it's possible, but it's very stupid of them if they allow this to happen, because, again, they're falling into, you know, the Colombians have always been very smart about the cocaine. So, you know, if you look at it, even back into the 80s, that they would insist upon they would buy coca paste from Peru and Bolivia, and they would insist upon turning it into cocaine. So then they're actually holding the valuable product, that kilo of cocaine. Compare that, say, with something like coffee. Well, when they sell the raw coffee abroad, it's the roaster in Italy who makes all of the profit. They're just selling the simple coffee beans. So if they're going to do this and fall into that trap again of just selling off the raw material, I think it's a very, very bad business plan, because the Mexicans, essentially the Colombians, were happy in the 90s to do this deal with the Mexican cartels. If you look at the 80s, you see there are Colombian cartels would export cocaine directly from Colombia to America, and they had their own distribution centers. Now, the price to getting it in roughly, I mean, the prices fluctuate, but let's just talk about Miami. Roughly to get a kilo of cocaine will cost you $25,000 in Miami. But what happened is the U.S. started cracking down, and really, so it became ever harder for the Colombians to make that final bit of the journey, that last 10% to get it into the U.S. And a lot of shipments started being caught. They were losing money. So they agreed to this deal that they would then sell to Mexico for about $10,000 a kilo, roughly. Yeah, they're losing a lot, but it's more guaranteed supply, a kind of very business-like decision. But if they're going to then start selling it in Colombia, well, in Colombia, they're going to be selling that kilo for like $2,000. I mean, the loss that they'll be taking on would just be overwhelming, I think. But maybe that's the evolution. Who knows? But then you would assume that a narco militia would be strong enough to tell the Mexicans, hey, you're here as our guests. Because again, how many people can the Mexicans really summon if it comes to a war? That's always been my suspicion, that, you know, if the Clan del Golfo really wants to go to war, what are the Mexicans going to do? I don't know. So I don't know, but it can't be good to have these Mexican cartels in Colombia. I mean, I guess that's an understatement, but who knows how it's going to end up being. But just a final point, I would say, after 15 years of really being with the coca farmers, and really listening to them and going to these coca towns, places like Llorente, Tumaco, which is just filled with, there's prostitutes, there's the cocaleros come in, they sell their product, and then they just have weekend parties. Like Avara has a very similar culture. What struck me for the first time, but so we've had a full generation of cocaine, roughly 20 years these people have lived with these coca economies. All of the peasants I spoke to, all of the small farmers, they seem genuinely tired of this. I would guess if the government came out with a sensible plan, you would get 50% would sign up tomorrow morning. The people are tired of it. They understand the money's no longer there. This was the really interesting thing. So essentially, I mean, without dragging on too much, essentially what you have now is you have a system where the coca farmer has to sell to one of these groups, be it the EPL, the ELN, or the dissidents. That means they establish the price. Well, the price hasn't gone up. It's roughly 1.2, 1.4 million pesos for a coca paste. That's the same price as it was 15 years ago. So they don't even have the money anymore, and they've got all of the drawbacks of living a life in cocaine. That means that the town is run by these narco militias. The violence is everywhere. You can't plot anything. Your society has virtually collapsed around you. No one trusts anyone. Your neighbor ran off with a prostitute. You know, there's STDs in your tiny little village because of the prostitutes have come in from places like Cali, Medellin, bringing these. It's just, it's all of a downside now, and the money's not even there. So I was really struck by that. How many people want to leave this life. Unfortunately, that's going to require an ambitious, visionary government to step up with a comprehensive plan. And I just don't see any evidence of that on the horizon, unfortunately.
No, I don't see any ambitious government here at the moment. But that's fascinating about the money. I had no idea that it really hadn't changed, let's say, the price in 15 years. I had no idea at all. So, of course, I mean, your earnings have decreased significantly, but you're still trapped in this endless cycle of violence and prostitution and cocaine and weapons and whatever else goes with it. And so, this is a huge investigation. You say, you've been researching it, let's say, for 15 years because you've been here for 15 years, but the crux of this main information in 3 months, you obviously tapped into all of your old, informants and fixers and so on and so forth. And you say, a little bit of a weird situation there in Norte Santander on the border. But I mean, were you at any point in the research for this book, did you really fear for your own personal safety? I know this is kind of a glib question. You are a war correspondent and well-blooded Syria, Iraq, and so on. But, these are still tricky situations that you find yourself in. Were there any situations where you can share with us as I have to get out of here?
Sure. I mean, in Norte de Santander, I mean, you're constantly, just to take a step back, when we worked in these areas of the FARC, before the peace process, there were unofficial rules of just living. I mean, there was a logic to it. It may not have been evident from the cities, but people understood what they were doing. They understand certain things. Essentially, the FARC wouldn't, these groups, whether they be paramilitaries, ELN, or the FARC, really wouldn't mess with the foreign press, because I think they just understood, we don't need that hassle. You know, the possible ramifications of this going wrong. Now, all of those rules are gone. So we saw with Huacho in Tumaco, where he just killed these three Ecuadorian journalists. It shot him right to the head of South America's most wanted. Effectively, he signed his own death warrant, but he had lost that institutional knowledge to not know not to do that. So you're dealing with people who are very unpredictable at the moment. These dissident FARC are very unpredictable. So that was a constant kind of worry. We were in some kind of event drinking around with cocaleros out in the campo, and then you're out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, again, it's just one of the major themes of my book is just how abandoned these communities are by the central government. I mean, these places would take 6 hours to get to from the nearest kind of major town. And when you looked on the map, I couldn't believe it. I was looking at a distance of, as the crow flies, 30 kilometers, but would take you 6 hours. So we're out there in the middle of nowhere, and then, guys get drunk and they start shouting, vamos a matar este huevo puto gringo. And that's, it's like, all right, how serious is this? You you're going to get ready, but you don't know. There were other instances when we went out with the eradication units of the police. I went out with them. And as soon as we touched down and met up with the eradication, some guy starts peeling off shots in the jungle. No idea what that was about. But, everybody's scrambling through the undergrowth. Everybody gets ready. Is this going to be a firefight? There's kind of like 10 more gunshots and that's it. And just everyone moves on. No idea who that was. When you get into hanging out with the sicarios and the traffickers, that becomes worrisome in the sense that if anything bad happens, the responsibility is likely to fall on you. You're the new factor in this equation. So you kind of feel like, for fuck's sake, I hope there's not a massive police operation against these guys that happens while I'm in town. Because if there is, they're going to think I was responsible. These guys don't get they don't get far in that world, in the underworld, by being overly trusting. Now, I had come via a guy I've known for various years who has a lot of trust with them. But still, that will only take you that far. And the mafia even have their own rules about that. They have this detour, which is who introduces the person pays. And so that was the way, so el que presenta paga, I think what it is. So that was their way of that if someone introduced me, and I was, which obviously I'm not, if I was an undercover DEA agent, later that person couldn't turn around and say, oh, I didn't know. No, the rule is iron. You presented, you introduced him to us, you pay the price. And that's their way. And again, it's this sign of the constant thing of this world of chaos and these men and women of cocaine. They're always trying to impose order on, they're trying to establish these rules, but it's like the Old West, you know, it's just a very fascinating thing to see. So in terms of danger, that was a constant thing. And you're trying to avoid overhearing too much information because the last thing you want is this drug trafficker to wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and say, you know what, I shouldn't have told him that. Oh, well, you know, this is what we've got to do. So it was this constant walking the tightrope, if you see what I mean.
Yes, no, definitely. And again, very interesting indeed that I did. Again, I guess you vouch for someone, isn't it? It's being vouched for on that, but with a lot more on the line. You mentioned in a little bit of your talk earlier on that you talked about the police, the sicarios, the army. You talked about those. You also threw in a mention of their witches. Tell us, you have to, because it's something that's so fascinating to me. I wasn't going to let this one go. The traffickers or the capos, their own witches or shaman who bless them or do all sorts of, I don't know, conjuring or so on and so forth. Tell us a little bit about this.
Well, I, this was one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book, because I thought cocaine had weirdly become in a lot of recent kind of literature about cocaine, it's been weirdly reduced to the idea of hectares of coca and government spending on eradication. And no, this is a wild world where sex is everywhere. It's dangerous. It's exciting. It's glamorous on one hand and deeply cynical and filled with betrayal and filled with these wild and weird characters. So the trafficker I got to know had his own witch. And this guy would perform, he was telling me about these witches are just filled with these wild stories. He would tell me the one that they wanted was he had to sacrifice a cat. And then he would have to burn the cat's corpse. Then he would take the bones from a cat. With those bones, he would do some sort of spell over those bones. And then the bones would go with the shipment of cocaine. And that was to try and they think that will kind of bless it with invisibility. So it's not that it's 100% invisible. It's just that the man in the customs just doesn't look at it as he should. He just kind of looks anywhere else. But they deeply believe in all of these things. So the witch was telling me about the other kind of spells he's put on someone. The other witches put these spells where they force a woman to fall in love with a man, or they force a man to fall in love with a woman. He said that's a very common thing, but he says what happens is everybody around this person doesn't recognize them anymore because they're acting so strangely in their new life of being in love with this person. So you're talking almost like they're creating these kind of zombies who follow these people around, now in love with them, all because of witchcraft. And again, Colombia is a land of old gods and witchcraft and weird stuff in the jungles. And, you know, there's a lot of people out there who believe in this witchcraft. I met various people who would do these kind of spells and incantations, as well as the hitmen, the assassins, who go to pray to the Virgin of the Assassins, who they believe will protect them when they do their jobs. And that's, again, trying to explain to the world outside, how do you get a man who kills for a living who will then go and pray to the Virgin Mary in order to make his job of being a professional killer more efficient. That's a wild tale that I don't think has really been told and that the world doesn't know. Basically, I'm taking a lot of the things that we know about in Colombia, but actually the rest of the world doesn't know about. And that was kind of the idea for this book.
I get this. I get exactly where you're from. You know, you and I talk, and we've lived, seen. I've not been as deep in as you, and so on. My hat is taken off to you, and so on. But it becomes the norm. Hearing these things. It becomes the norm. Hearing that someone's been doing witchcraft or something else, or someone's related to someone else who's incredibly corrupt, who's had some people killed, who's done this, who's robbed land from indigenous people, and so on. But when you go outside of Colombia and you say this in a de facto matter of fact manner, and everyone's like, you what? Basic but really trivial example from my perspective was working in the jungles of Ecuador a long time ago and just telling some people around a dinner table once in London as well, when the generator's off, and they're like, you don't have electricity. He's like, well, it's just normal. You get up when it's light and you go to bed when it's dark. But there's no knowledge of that. But you're taking this to a great extreme, which is far more interesting to read about. And so would you say that this is a collection of articles around the kilo traveling across the country, then up into the, you know, wherever else it's going to be sold, wherever you follow the kilo? Or do you, it's properly connected all the way through as a narrative in a book?
Oh, no, it's properly connected. And again, I keep hitting the same themes, because essentially the underworld, everyone in the underworld who I interviewed and kind of hung out with came through my acquaintance of this one couple, this one trafficker, the kind of mid-range trafficker. He was the guy who would kind of sign off and say, yes, you can interview my sicario, who served as his bodyguard, interview his girlfriend, interview his witch. So it's very connected. And again, it was to kind of show that, you know, to really take it from the coca leaf, right, as far along. And I think, you know, you do really feel that this coca has gone on this journey, and just how many hands it goes through. You know, and also to kind of show the world, this is a huge industry. There are tens of thousands of people, if not hundreds of thousands of people, who directly live off this industry. I mean, once you throw in the coca farmers, you know, I mean, there are hundreds of thousands of people in Colombia. And the timing of the book is also because we now have more cocaine being produced than ever before in history. I mean, that's just, you know, the world doesn't realize, I think, what's coming is that the world is already, but I don't think, again, the media have caught up to this. It's awash in pure, cheap cocaine. I was just before we started this, an article caught my eye. For the first time in Ireland's history, or certainly in recent years, last year in Ireland, more people checked in for addiction to cocaine than heroin. If you go around all of these countries in the world, you can see that you can see the red flags. Germany announcing its largest bust of cocaine ever. The United States announcing its largest bust of cocaine. Sure, if you look at it on the front, it's like, oh my God, yeah, the police are knocking it out of the park. Good for them. No, you're supposed to actually look, my God, how much cocaine is out there. If you look at Florida already, in the African-American community in the United States, their rates of overdose for cocaine are matching the rates of overdose for white populations with heroin, opioids. DEA is warning that cocaine overdoses in Florida, again, you know, Florida, the gateway to Latin America, are seeing a 10-year high of cocaine overdoses. This cocaine has been made, and now it needs to get out to the world. And another thing I kind of wanted to get into in this book is to actually examine, all right, what is cocaine? It's not just another drug. It never has been. It's always been associated with glamour. So at one point I call it promiscuous, but also exclusive, because it's always been expensive. It's always been a kind of status. What tells a young entrepreneur in Africa, in a booming economy, that they've made it? Friday night, a couple of extra grams of cocaine, because he or she has seen that in the movies. That's what they did in Wall Street. That's what they do in London. Cocaine chases these economic booms. It's always there. And now we just don't even know what to do with all of these hundreds of tons of cocaine around the planet. And I think we're in for a surprise. I don't think America's ready for this. I don't think Britain's ready for this. We are going to see a lot of people overdose and die because of cocaine.
Quickly, as we wind this down, unfortunately, when you talk about the chain of how many people, so let's say, handle the cocaine, how did you come up with a figure in the end from let's say the plant to, you know, the, I guess, the silver platter in Miami?
No, I mean, it's I find so much of the underworld. I think we've we are just, I think, I don't know why we stop being ashamed to say, hey, look, I just don't know that. It's the underworld. You know? I mean, it's just impossible to quantify certain things. And I think so many of the statistics people throw around are just made up. I mean, we just don't know the true extent of this. I'm not sure that we really understand how many hectares of coca are out there. When I wanted to do this book, one of the first things I said, and I wasn't able to follow through, one of the first ideas for this book is I don't want a single statistic in this book, because I feel like we've lost contact with what this really is. This is a violent, bloodthirsty business. And we made it become almost anemic. It was like, oh, well, you know, if we can explain it in terms of tons and percentages and Plan Colombia and stuff. And no, this is a business of bloodshed, betrayal. And I wanted to kind of get back to that emotional heart of the business, the fear, the terror, the glamour, the violence, the despair. And that was the kind of story I wanted to tell. That's why I kind of tell this story through these people's lives.
And so we have to ask it. We have to ask the solution, Toby. You know, having delved so deep into this, what's our solution then?
I mean, so just in terms of book, I kind of wanted to say, I didn't want it to turn into a polemic because I don't know what the solution is. What I know isn't working is the war on drugs. I mean, that is just, and that is why. And again, I just wanted to show the world the war on drugs has turned this country upside down because, but I think it's too facile. I'm seeing an argument emerge. Right, let me rephrase it. It's good to always center that the demand from places like America and London is what propels the industry. You know, Colombia stops producing cocaine tomorrow if everybody stops buying. Fine, that's obviously true. But I don't think we look back on the era of prohibition and point at the guy who went out and bought his pint of beer and say he was the problem. I don't think we look at him or the guy or the woman who bought her cocktail and say she is responsible for Al Capone. No, we look back at prohibition and say this was a bad law and it created these mafias. And I think we need to do the same thing, that this is a bad policy of deciding to treat this as not only in places like England and America, we treat this as a criminal matter instead of a health issue. In Colombia, we treat it as a war issue. And everything that I see from the Colombian government is not inspiring confidence. Again, when you look at the figures, the best form of getting these coca farmers to stop planting coca is voluntary substitution, i.e. where the farmer rips out the crop of coca and is given a way of earning another. The worst is this fumigation. And what people forget is, I don't have the figure there, but everyone's saying, oh, let's go back to fumigation, despite the fact that this might be causing cancer. Despite that, let's just look, even at the height of Uribe being able to fumigate wherever he wants, Colombia still was producing 30 to 40,000 hectares of coca a year. So even when they had all of the toys they wanted and they could do it with the strongest, toughest president, they still couldn't crack that, you know? So I think the war on drugs is the thing that urgently needs. And I'll say this about the former president Santos. I think in many times he was too easy to scare and he allowed himself to be kind of dictated to by the Uribistas, knowing what they would say. He would accommodate themselves too much to Colombia's right wing. He wasn't certain a lot of his policies. But he had tremendous bravery, I think, to try to get the world to engage in a conversation on what to do about drugs. And he repeatedly said, we need to look at possibly even up to legalizing cocaine. I'm not saying that's what I believe, but I admire his bravery in trying to get the world talking about this. And I think it speaks deeply, very badly of the rest of the world, that they just pretended they didn't hear it. And so the war on drugs just keeps rolling by and countless more people will be killed because of it. It's a tragedy.
I've always admired President Santos for his ability, you know, to say we need to start talking about this. You know, he's not openly saying, but as you say, the dialogue, the conversation needs to be engaged upon. That's where we found ourselves with him, and then of course, you know, everything's gone. Set, I would say we've turned the clock back a bit since then. But yes, he was ignored. It did completely fall on deaf ears, which was disappointing. I think, disappointing, because at the very least, a dialogue, you know, you could put brains together and start thinking, let's really see how best to do this. And when you think, and I will be getting my hands on a copy of your book when it's out, because I'm fascinated. I've been to some of these, but you know, we're out in the wilds of Kakheta and Meta and stuff, you know, and the people who live in this utter isolation, just trying to make ends meet, you know, the, as you said, peasants, smallholders, so on, just wanting to sell a product at a nearby highway to be able to, you know, cater in the most, I would say, simple or innocent ways. A bit of healthcare, a bit of education, running water, you know, obviously a bit more. I don't want to, you know, completely, you know, undermine certain issues. But these are just people trying to get by. And now they happen to be in areas that are controlled by other groups because the government hasn't moved in, or the government hasn't done this, or the government hasn't done that. It's a tricky situation. And I don't see a solution, and I don't see fumigation as a solution. And crop substitution would be great, but everything was pegged to cacao, and then the money, the bottom fell out of cacao as well, and their price. So it's just so complex.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's really interesting. You talk about the cacao, because one of the guys who was working, I mean, you learn stuff there that I just didn't even know, because, and I consider myself a pretty decent student of the drugs industry. But where we were in Norte de Santander, in this one spot, this guy was telling me he had used to be a farmer of cacao. And he said that as soon as the government helped him get into cacao, and then he said immediately the government turned around and did some international trade deals with prominent producers of cacao. So he said at one point, I think he said that when they first started, he could sell it, the kilo was something like $7 or something. When they did these trade deals, I think with Ecuador, and I think he mentioned an African country as well, Colombia was flooded by cheaper cacao. And it was that the price collapsed to like $1.50. So then he said that he goes to this and he works in the laboratories for 3 months to earn enough money. And then he goes back. So he's producing the coca paste for a farmer. And we were doing this kind of back of the envelope calculations about how much the farmer was earning. For 1 hectare of coca, we figured you could get probably a kilo and a half of coca paste. We think that guy could have been earning for every 2 months 900,000 pesos in total, when you take away all out of all of his expenses.
Yes.
It's nothing. I mean, that's 450,000. And again, to this level of abandonment, what you said about a lack of running water. In this part of Norte de Santander, Catatumbo, which is astonishingly beautiful, by the way, it was a region I didn't really know that well. And again, it's the part of the world where the most lightning strikes fall. So you have these every night, these phenomenal thunderstorms. But sorry, it's just stunningly beautiful, the whole region. But the campesinos were showing me the school that they themselves had to collect the money. It took them 4 years. The government hadn't built a school. What the hell is the government doing there? And then, so the peasants themselves had to put up a little piaje on the dirt track. So the coca farmers would come by, and every time they went by, they would drop off like 2,000 pesos. That was the toll. But all of that money was coming from coca. So coca is building that school. That's how entrenched it is, and the government is nowhere to be seen. So, yeah, exactly. So what do we expect from people? We kind of put them at the margins and then say, hey, you know, we forced you to the margins of society, but don't you break the rules. You know, and quite rightly, the people say, screw it. You know, I like you. I don't know what the solution is, but it seems a complete overhaul is what we need. You know, I mean, just but yeah, it's going to require ambition, vision, courage. And unfortunately, I don't think Colombia elects those types of politicians. I know, you know, there's a handful that I really do respect, and I think are just very, very interesting people. But the majority seem to be just some of the worst people you could possibly imagine. I just don't see, but again, these are Colombians' fault. I mean, they vote for them. And there's a long history of political violence, and I get it, you know, but it's still, I mean, I don't know. I can't pinpoint anyone on that and say, okay, this person has a decent chance of being elected and that they would have the courage and the vision to undertake the massive changes that need to occur. I hope I'm wrong. I genuinely hope I'm wrong.
The economic backing as well. It's such a huge undertaking. But listen, everyone out there, listen, that was Toby Muse, very well written, very famous war correspondent, foreign correspondent, but based here in Colombia for a great many years, 15 years or so. He's been in Iraq and Syria. He's talking about his new book out in March, and it is called Kilo: Inside the Deadliest Cocaine Cartels, from the jungles to the streets. And that's out in March 2020. You'll be able to get it in good bookstores, on Amazon, of course, I'm sure Barnes and Noble, other places like that. Correct me if I'm wrong, if I've missed something out, but thank you so much for sharing this with us and telling us a bit about the experience and a little bit about your insights. And basically, I mean, I don't want to say we're screwed, but it's just a whole, we need to somehow, it's kind of reboot the thinking process around this somehow. I don't have the solution. I mean, you don't have the solution, but two heads are better than one, I guess. Getting the book out there will hopefully open up a greater debate around this.
Absolutely. That's the most I could hope for. But thank you so much for having me on your show. It's a great show. It's an honor to be on. I really enjoyed it. And I hope I can come back on someday.
We'll have you on after it's launched, and after some of the, you know, when you get the amazing reviews out in the New York Times and others. And I said, well, I had you on Columbia Calling first.
Let's do that.
Well, listen, thank you so much again. I know that my listeners out there have enjoyed this immensely. We've been talking to Toby Muse, and of course, one more time, his book is available for pre-order on Amazon. It's called Kilo: Inside the Deadliest Cocaine Cartels, from the Jungles to the Streets, and you can find that on Amazon very easy, and it's up there, and I'm sure it's going to be an amazing read. I will definitely get my hands on it. This has been episode 302 of the Colombia Calling podcast. Be sure to come back next week. I don't know when I'm getting him back on, but you'll remember from a few months ago, there's the Briton Daniel Eggington, who wants to walk through the Darien Gap, through the more dangerous side of the Darien Gap. He wants to come back on the show when he's arrived in Medellin, so just a few short days before he sets off on his hike through that area of Colombia. And I know a lot of you have asked after him, so I'll keep you updated on his movements. But again, thank you, and of course, keep sharing the news, keep sharing the podcast, keep on talking about it, and we'll keep on finding and interviewing interesting people talking and doing amazing things in Colombia. So thank you again for listening, and bye-bye.